What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Heavily Armed Clown, aka Colin, host of the Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast, co-founder of the website WTFHappenedIn1971.com. I think if there's a battle going on in Twitter for ideas, Heavily Armed Clown's been dropping truth bombs like gold failed as money. Governments have been successfully able to postpone liquidation to the base layer, gold, for centuries. I really want to dig into a lot of your ideas. So let's just get right into it. I consider the WTF happened in 1971 website and meme really important. I don't think a lot of people understand the root cause of our problems and I think there's a lot of externalities that they kind of get used to distract them and used to pit them against each other. And I think that this website and this meme really cuts through a lot of that noise. I think it's great because the idea and the data precedes Bitcoin. It's outside of Bitcoin. And a lot of times when I get into discussions with people about money and Bitcoin in particular, I feel like this is a great way to follow up with them and show them something just outside of Bitcoin, but that there is a problem regardless of what they think the solution might be. So, you know, what the fuck happened in 1971? You know, and obviously it goes back before that. So tell us, like, what's going on?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. It's one of those conversations where it's kind of like, where do you start? Because there's so much dogma and misinformation these days, particularly around the topics of inflation and deflation. And one that I've run into that up until recently I found difficult to refute was the difference between a money and a currency. And obviously you were just mentioning the base layer liquidation of money, which I think is a really important point, because as I've tried to sort these things out in my mind and get what's in my brain out on paper to try to make other people understand what I think I can see, is that currency is a layer, you know, a higher order layer of the base layer money. And traditionally, you know, throughout much of human history, the best base layer money, the dominant base layer money, was gold and silver specie, right? That was what banks large traders typically preferred to settle in, because that was the base layer. And then we had all of these other financial instruments built on top of that, whether that be bank notes, whether that be debt, whether that be equity, whether that be fiat currency, which sort of supplanted bank notes and took away people's ability to settle back on the base layer, which was gold and silver bullion. And then you have, you know, gold and silver coinage, which again, I think is sort of like a layer built on top of the gold and silver, which is what people were ultimately after. So what happened in 1971? You know, that is a good question. And you do kind of have to go back to really understand the history. But essentially, what happened in 1971 was the closure of the gold window. The United States, as well as quite a lot of other countries in the world, not the entire world, but a lot of the developed nations at the time, were under the system of Bretton Woods, which was formed in 1945, up until the closure of the gold window in 1971.
Maybe before we get into the closing of the gold window, I guess to kind of lead up to that, can you dig into a little bit about Bretton Woods and where that put us on a global order?
Bretton Woods was sort of like the United States flexing its muscles a little bit towards the end of World War II and establishing a new monetary hegemonic order. Essentially, what the deal with Bretton Woods was all currencies, all other currencies of nations that were participants of Bretton Woods, were pegged to the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar was pegged to gold. I believe it was at $35 an ounce. And I think that might have changed at a couple points in time throughout the system, but I'm not entirely sure on that. I know towards the end it was pegged at $35 an ounce. But the problem was, The incentives for just about everybody in that system were to cheat, right? It was to print more paper notes than there was gold in the system. So the United States government had to go through an awful lot of struggle, particularly when the London Gold Pool reopened a decade or so after World War I ended, to keep the price of gold pegged to $35 an ounce. And they actually ended up losing a huge amount of their gold in the process. If you go and look at our website, there's a chart on there that shows U.S. gold treasury reserves. And you'll see throughout the 60s, pretty much actually through the 50s and 60s, the U.S. gold reserves in the treasury just drop like a rock. And that was because the United States was trying to fix the price of gold at $35 an ounce, despite the fact that they were printing more dollars than they should have been, and that all the other countries whose currencies were pegged to the dollar were also printing more notes than they should have been. So the whole thing just fell apart because of the nature of incentive, right? Human incentives are that, you know, when you have the ability to print money, you will take advantage of the seniorage of that.
Right. So I think, you know, even preceding this in 19, I don't remember exactly what year, 33, they make gold illegal to be owned. And then they fix the rate was at $32 an ounce or $35 an ounce at that point. And then we fast forward to 1971. I think the issue there was more of international settlement, like you were touching on, the gold-based layer. How much of this was, you know, Nixon's idea or maybe people pushing or entities pushing Nixon? And yeah.
So say what you want about Nixon. You know, I'm not here to go to bat for any politician, but I think that the nails were in the coffin long before Nixon took office. It's like I said, you know, you can look at the chart and see that the U.S. Treasury reserves were dwindling long before Nixon ever took office. And a lot of people blame a lot of different things for the anomalies that you see on our site, particularly things like peak oil, which is ridiculous because we produce more oil today than we ever have. Mechanization, industrialization, destruction of the unions, women entering the workforce, immigration. They try to pin it, globalization is another one. They try to pin it on a whole lot of things. But obviously, you know, Ben and I, the two who created the website, don't tend to see any of those things as necessarily disruptive enough. And if you're Austrian, you know, then you don't really necessarily see globalized trade as a bad thing. You see that makes the world more wealthy when you're operating in a system that fairly incentivize economic action, which is sound money, right?
And right.
Not artificial inflation, disruption of economic calculation, all those types of things.
Yeah. So what happens in 1971 as a result of Nixon's order?
So in 1971, Nixon closed the gold window, meaning that effectively dollars could no longer be redeemed for gold. And the interesting thing about this is that for United States citizens, at least, this wasn't really a big deal. Like if you talk to anybody who was alive at the time, at least from based on the conversations that I've had with people who were around at the time, because I hadn't been born yet. I was 20 years out from being a fetus.
Fair enough.
They'll say, yeah, I remember that. Like we watched that on TV or my dad talked about that or he read about it in the paper. But life went on, right? I mean,
right.
Nobody was like, wow, our money's not pegged to gold anymore. And the reason is because of Executive Order 6102, which you mentioned previously, which in 1933, the FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt implemented Executive Order 6102 during the Great Depression as a part of the New Deal, effectively making it illegal for United States citizens to own bullion. They could own gold certificates, but they could not own bullion, which effectively meant they could not redeem dollars for gold at any point in time during the Bretton Woods system.
Right.
So Bretton Woods was a way for nation states to settle at the base layer, right?
Yeah, I think
I like to go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I think I've heard you speak about this, and it's very interesting. You said, you know, one, maybe people weren't really redeeming their paper money for gold. And something else you've said is, you know, gold is dead and paper beat gold. Paper is better than gold. And so I think that, you know, part of this transition maybe is that, you know, there are benefits to moving to paper. But I think, you know, the ills that we're looking at in society are from the peg. and having that hard money back, that that hard, the money being backed.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I would say that paper beat gold. I would say that paper was a higher order layer of gold.
Okay.
Right? And when, because of the centralization, because of trusted third parties involved in the physical settlement of the base layer of gold, which is bullion, right?
Right.
Especially at large volumes, there's a high cost of physical settlement there. And there's a high cost of auditability, right? Because you have to verify that the gold is real. You have to guard it. You have to take it where you need it to go. And that's an expensive process. So that process naturally centralized itself over time to the organizations that could fulfill the overhead on the actual base layer settlement. And through that process, governments were able to disrupt settlement to the base layer. And this is something that I've been talking about a lot recently. Because if you go back and study the financial panics in the United States throughout the 19th century, you'll see a common theme, which is that the government creates too much money, which is something that they did even back in the days of the gold standard. Long before Bretton Woods, the government came up with creative ways to create more money, more inflation. And usually it was through things like bonds and then forcing private banks to buy those bonds and then allowing them to hold them as collateral, meaning that they could create more banknotes because that the government debt was considered good collateral, right? Because, right. Well, we're a sovereign entity. Of course, we'll repay you. We're insolvent or we're unable to become insolvent. So that debt was held as collateral and it was very inflationary. And then the banks would print more money than they had specie. And then bank runs would happen because financial downturns would happen because of malinvestment. And people would run to the banks and they'd try to pull out all their gold, right? Because that was the money that they would settle to the base layer, the liquidation, as I like to call it. And it never failed. For every major financial panic in the United States at the late 18th century, all the way through the 19th century, the federal government's response was always suspension of redemption of specie, meaning that they put a halt to the liquidation process where people wanted to settle to the base layer, right? They wanted to return mm-hmm. to the lowest level. They wanted to settle out all of their outstanding liabilities, all of their IOUs, which when you think about it, that's all a banknote is an IOU. You give me this gold, I'll give you this paper note. And when you want, you can come back and exchange it. And this will just make your life easier. So when things become uncertain economically, right, you want to settle back to the base layer. If you're a bank and you're holding my 5 gold bars and I'm worried that you're insolvent, well, I want to go give you your notes back and get back my gold because that's what you promised me when we set that arrangement up. So by suspending redemption of specie, these banks effectively halted the process of liquidation, settlement to the base layer. And I keep calling that for a reason, because it helps explain this process and how it became corrupted later on. So my theory, I don't even know if it's a theory, but my way of explaining this is that Executive Order 6102, the creation of the Federal Reserve, and ultimately the closure of the gold window in 1971, were all really just continuations of what the United States government had been doing for a century, which was halting the process of liquidation, halting settlement to the base layer, which, like I said, the free market had always preferred to be gold. And it just so happened that the government sort of figured out a way, you know, through enough abstraction and enough time where people no longer really thought about bullion as money. Mm-hmm. They were willing to just take paper.
Right. Yeah. I really think that, you know, the website and the meme is very striking, and I still want to kind of explore what happens after 1971. Every chart spikes at that time. Obviously, the gold window closes. What is going on? I mean, it looks like productivity is rising. It looks like earnings are not for the middle class. It looks like divorce rate is rising. It looks like a lot of society is getting distorted. And why does the gold window being closed really drive that or accelerate that?
Right. So essentially, when the gold window was closed, now all of a sudden, there was nobody to hold the United States government in particular accountable for how many paper notes it printed, right? Particularly the Federal Reserve, who issues the currencies, and Congress, who controls the spending, and the Treasury, who allegedly backs all that up with, you know, the assets that it holds. It used to be gold. It's not really anymore. There's not nearly enough gold, you know, and it's funny, people don't understand this history. If you go and ask them, like, you know, what backs the value of the dollar, some of them will say all the gold that's in the United States Treasury, because they've abstracted away through so many layers of obfuscation what a dollar really is, or what it represents, or historically, you know, what it represented. And you know, it was something that was really kind of what got me into economics as a kid, is like, what is money? Right. Where does it come from? Who decides how much there is, and when do they decide that, and how? But ultimately,
where you're a kid and you're starting to question money, where do you turn to, or what are kind of your path from there? Obviously, or it seems like you're an Austrian economist. And I have a really strong foundation in economics. And I'm assuming you didn't get that at college or university.
No, absolutely not. I think, you know, I took like an economics class in high school. And I think what most do is what I did, which was, you know, you take your economics class, and you learn about supply and demand, and you learn about elasticity, and you learn about money, and you learn about exchange, and you learn about monetary policy. And it kind of stops there. And then they say, You kind of get a peek at the rest. And it's like, if you really want to know this stuff, it's super complicated and you need to learn tons of mathematical formulas. And really, we just rely mostly on those wizards at the Federal Reserve, and they take care of it, right?
Yeah.
And then around the time I took that course, actually, was close to the time of the 2008 financial crisis. And it wasn't until years later, really until I started getting into, you know, investing in stock markets and Bitcoin in particular, which made me question what money was, that I found and the Fed by Ron Paul, which if you go through the references that he has in that book, tons of Austrians are just laced all throughout that book. And I, through that, I went to The Creature from Jekyll Island, and that just led me down the Austrian rabbit hole, you know, Mises and Rothbard and Hayek, and, you know, you can name them. I've probably read at least something from them.
What did you get out of the Jekyll Island for people who are not familiar with it?
Primarily that we're just being scammed. And the book, you know, if you're intimidated by economics, and if you've never read anything like, you know, it's a pretty big book. It's like 600 or 700 pages, but it doesn't read like an economics textbook. It reads like a history book, or like a mystery story, like a whodunit. So if you dig into it, if you're like me and you have a curious mind, you'll find yourself not able to put it down. You'll find, you know, what's kind of been a common thread throughout all of history, but you're not taught in terms of American history, is that people take advantage of power dynamics. People take advantage of incentives. And when small groups of people are given power over a certain dynamic, they extort that power for their own gain, right? And that's exactly what happened in our banking and financial system.
Yeah, all of this seems really orchestrated to me. And I wonder how much of these boom and bust cycles are, you know, planned in advance. You know, not by maybe 12 people in a room, but by 1,000 people or 4,000 people, kind of driven ahead of time. And how much do you think it's really just happenstance, and this is where we ended up because humans are greedy, and we just lost our peg to gold and hard money, versus orchestrated and just really enriches a few, and they're driving this because it benefits them?
Well, I don't so much say that it's orchestrated so much as that it can be forecasted, because it's natural, right? That, you know, look into the Austrian business cycle and you'll see, look back at history all throughout America's financial history. And I talk about America because it's what I know, right? Because I'm American. You can see examples of this throughout monetary history all over the world. But if you look back throughout America's financial history, you'll see periods of inflation. And when I say inflation, I'm not talking about the way the Federal Reserve calculates it. I'm talking about an increase in the monetary base, just so your listeners understand. I'm not talking about CPI.
Right.
An increase in the monetary base, and then you'll see an inflationary boom, so to speak, right? Where the money is flowing, everyone is making money, everyone is investing, everyone is speculating. People are you know, if it was the 19th century, people are going out and buying railroad stocks or buying land to build railroads. And then 10 years later, the credit contracts, the money supply contracts, and everyone finds out, oh, 30 of those 40 railroad companies that we invested in no longer exist because they never did anything productive with the capital that we allocated to them. And then you have this huge financial downturn, this credit crunch. This is a normal process. And normally there's not, well, Austrian economics is very theoretical, so there shouldn't be this artificial increase in the money supply. But what drives it typically, from what I've seen, is governments and governments wanting to protect their ability to be the ultimate sovereign, their ability to spend more than they take in revenue. It's a very powerful tool as a government to be able to spend more than you collect in revenue from your citizenry, because you know then they don't necessarily directly feel that pain. They feel it 5 years later, 10 years later, and then you just say, oh no, don't worry, inflation's good for you. Inflation is what's necessary. It's the engine of the economy.
Yeah. I think we both agree that, you know, and I think your website really lays it out clearly, is that we're facing a broken monetary system. And things are not functioning the way they should. You know, you see negative interest rates and things of this nature. And what do you think is the solution? Or do you think actually, and before we get to maybe the solution, do you think people are waking up to this? And how long do you see this playing out for this current cycle? And do you see hyperinflation happening to the dollar?
Okay, that was a lot of questions all in one. So you asked me a couple questions earlier that I didn't really get to, and they kind of fit in here. But you basically asked me like what happened after 1971. And you know, I mentioned the inflation, and I tell you that's the expansion of the monetary base, not the price of butter going up or whatever.
Right.
Because the government subsidizes all of those things, and the government tweaks the formula in such a way to make it look like there's, oh, the prices of things, they haven't changed that much, don't worry about it. But what really matters is that your slice of the economic pie is getting smaller. With every dollar printed, your share of aggregate purchasing power is getting smaller. And so there's a formula, and it was created by a guy named Faustmann. I think it was in like the 17th or 18th century, and he was a forester. And he wanted to come up with a formula that would help him calculate when the optimal time was to cut down his trees, right? If he had a huge plot of land and had all kinds of hardwoods on it, he wanted to know, when is the best time for me to cut down these trees and maximize my profit? And he figured out that based on the accumulation of capital in society, discount rates, meaning the interest rates for him to acquire new capital to go out and purchase more land, would come down as capital accumulated in a society. And the replacement cost of as the replacement cost of capital comes down, the replacement cost of assets goes up. And likewise, it's the other way around. As capital is dispersed in a society and it's consumed, the replacement cost of capital goes up and the replacement cost of assets goes down. So when central banks manipulate the money supply and they manipulate the discount rate, the rate at which banks can borrow money, the rate at which you and I can borrow money,
right,
that distorts the process of economic calculation. It drives the cost of capital artificially low, right? That's why you hear people talk about the cost of capital, and banks and businesses can go out and get 0% interest loans overnight, right? But the cost of assets is extremely high, mm-hmm, right? That's something that we've seen a lot in the last 50 years, is inflation of assets. And that's why pretty much anybody you know who was born 60 years ago now is probably in a pretty good place financially, as long as they owned equities, as long as they owned houses, as long as they owned hard assets that appreciated in value and benefited from that asset inflation. Because pretty much since the 80s, since under Volcker, you know, under Reagan, the discount rate has only gone down ever since. And if you look at, we have a chart on our site, it's like the 3,000 year interest rate. And it shows in the 1970s, over this 3,000 year period, there's this huge anomaly spike in interest rates, which happened in the 1970s and the 1980s. And then since then, it's headed lower than it's ever been. And now it's pretty much effectively at zero, if not negative. In real terms, it's already negative. Nominally, it's still positive, but it might as well be negative. And that distorts the economic calculation. So you asked me the question, you know, where do I see this going? How long can this last? I don't know that anybody can answer that question, to be quite honest. I mean, how long do people's faith in a Ponzi scheme last? You know, how long was Bernie Madoff able to keep his scam going? I don't know. Are people waking up to this? That's a good question. I don't know that they are, right? I mean, it's for sure there's definitely like some glitches in the matrix. Like you look at people like Davy Day Trader, right? Barstool.
He's hilarious.
This guy's making money hand over fist. And all he's doing is just throwing money at the stock market.
Yeah,
and his like mantra is like, well,
like a dartboard. Like he's just throwing darts at a dartboard. Yeah. Pick any letters. Yeah.
The stock market always goes up. Why would you do anything else? It's so easy. He's like, oh, I'm going to show you Warren Buffett. You know, I'm the new.
But I think he gets it. I think he plays a bit of a character.
I think he
kind of sees through the BS. I think he knew that, you know, stock market's going to go up. You see it from even both political parties who tend, you know, and I think the Fed is obvious, is just beyond politicized at this point. But Nancy Pelosi came out and said, you know, the stock market's going to have a bottom, like a known bottom that we won't let it go below. That's a national security issue. You would think that if they were actually, you know, not fighting for the same teams, I think both parties really kind of serve the same interests. You know, they would not. She, from her position, probably wouldn't help him raise the market and cheapen the dollar and kind of benefit his administration, I would think, just from a political battle. And this show's not about going down left and right, because that's we're above that as Bitcoiners.
Well, it's a false dichotomy, right?
Right. It completely is. And that's why I don't think there is a left and a right. I think that there's a lot more, you know, I think there's really a center. I think most of us are in the center if we were to debate those issues. But I think those issues are a lot of them are nonsense and not really don't need to be held at a national level. They're really, you know, family based conversations, a lot, especially the social and cultural ones. And I kind of forgot where we were going with this, but I think both administrations are, you know, fighting to spend money and to print money and serve their own. Maybe there's a slightly different receivership base that they battle for and offer, you know, gifts to. And I think that's why they're also not held accountable to us, because they're not actually, you know, held to our actual tax dollars that we chip in. And you could see that very clearly, like on an issue like marijuana, where like, I don't know, over 45 states are either recreational or medicinal. And at a federal level, there's just no response. There's no movement. But the people have clearly spoken on that issue, wherever you stand. You know, 47 states have kind of, you know, voted. And I think they're just not really beholden to us on any of these issues, because they don't need our money at the end of the day.
Right. I mean, who are you going to vote for? The party that wants to deficit spend $3 trillion or the party that wants to deficit spend $4
trillion? Well, it depends on if I'm part of the three or the $4 trillion. I think that's right. How they're, you know, they're going for the votes. I mean, they're professional campaigners. So
that's not the way politics always worked in America, right? You go back and look at the creation of the Democratic Party, right, under Andrew Jackson. That was his attempt to try to return America to Jeffersonian economic principles. Before Jackson created the Democratic Party, everyone mostly fell under either a Federalist or the Democratic Republicans, right? And the Democratic Republicans were the party of Thomas Jefferson.
James That's just Madison. A funny name. Considering where we are now, Democrats and Republicans,
Andrew Jackson was the last president to abolish the central bank and completely pay off the federal deficit, because that's what his party was created to do.
Mm-hmm.
How different is that from what we see today?
Well, it's completely different. And I think the founding fathers, that you said this, the founding fathers, you know, kind of knew that democracy leads to socialism. Or at least I heard this on one of your shows. And I think I never really thought about it in that framework. And I'm just really curious now, like, I think your website, to me, it's just, you know, I came to your website during the bear market of 2019. So there's a lot of clutter on Twitter, and that meme kind of broke through. And it was strange, because it was, I don't remember exactly when I heard that meme. But I also remember Heavily Armed Clown kind of like jumping in, you know, and that's also strange. You know, on Twitter and people are kind of anon at that point. I didn't connect you to your show or to the website. So I'm getting advice from Heavily Armed Clown and you know, it's a striking persona, and, but, you know, dropping, you know, truth bombs. and cutting through the noise. And then, you know, I don't think I knew that you were part of the, you know, behind the website, but somehow I ended up at the website. And it was just, you know, I mean, I even go back to like music I grew up with, like Marvin Gaye, Inner City Blues, who sings about, you know, inflation sky high, can't keep up, bills pile up, whatever. I probably got that little rhyme wrong, but I kind of always knew that inflation was evil or just kind of stealing. And, you know, before Bitcoin, you can kind of have this like, you know, this hopeless, pessimistic outlook because you don't have an escape valve. And there's nothing that's going to kind of be a lifeboat. And you kind of, I was one of those people who kind of thought about these things and then would give up because there was no one really to talk to about it. You know, but the website with all those charts, it's now something where you're not talking about a theme or something you kind of can see with your eyes, but now there's just data and turned into information. And I can bring that to people like really straight up in corporate America, you know, office workers, because you're not getting into, you know, Bitcoin can kind of be very off-putting to a lot of people in terms of it just, you know, magic internet money. Yeah, bro. Cool story. And, you know, this is like, well, regardless of what you think is going on, like, look at these charts and look at these spikes. And there's something going on here that I don't care if you don't agree with my proposed solution. But what can we do about this? Or, you know, and maybe then it starts getting into the conversation of how, you know, inflation is theft and the, you know, the malincentives in the system, and just kind of trying to wake people up to like, this is going to fuck our children. Right. So it was a really astounding piece of information or nugget to get upon. And I love how you guys kept it out of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And really kept that separate because it let it be an ammo that has nothing to do with Bitcoin. You could even bring it up to someone without even getting into Bitcoin.
Right.
I think that's powerful.
We've tried really hard to make sure that the only purpose of the website is to raise a rhetorical question. You know, what happened in 1971? I don't even want to give you the answer, right? I just want you to ask the question. And your answer might be something I totally disagree with, like completely 100% opposite disagree with. Like a lot of people say it was greed. We see just some absolutely crazy answers.
Like
to
what?
That question. The opening of Disney World. I was born that year. My favorite band broke up. You know, just a whole number of really silly things.
Like right.
Kissinger sold us out to China. Just all kinds.
That's
of
probably
ridiculous.
The only one that was probably with some, I wouldn't say a lot of footing, maybe, or maybe it does, but that was the only one that made any kind of sense. And some of those are, and I get that. I think a lot of people, you know, none of this is taught in school.
Right.
Which is why I think it's an orchestrated scam. You know, Keynesian economics is the only thing you learn in school. If you get into kind of economic theory, or just very, you never hear about Austrian economics.
Sure.
At all, I think. It didn't come across my mind until I got into the Bitcoin rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
And you start, you know, I mean, and that's its own rabbit hole. And that's why I started this show, is because through Bitcoin, I've gone through that portal where, you know, or just start recently, you go on Twitter and it's just information warfare. There's a lot going on. You're coming across a lot of different compelling thoughts, opinions, ideas. But Bitcoin was the only one that held up to every, you know, piece of ammunition someone put at it. And then that leads to your Austrian economics, which there's even a fight between some Bitcoiners and Austrian economists. But like, there's a lot that I took from Austrian economics that I would not have learned if I didn't come to Bitcoin. And then there are other issues, you know, like the Second Amendment. And you start looking at things from first principles. You know, someone who grew up very liberal, like, forget whatever you think about the Second Amendment, you just throw out something like 3D printers and you're like, well, what are you going to do? You know, this is not, you know, and this is just technology that you can't put back in the box, and you kind of have to deal with that from a different, that's a different first principle. And You know, and then even just simple things like, you know, Pierre Richard's, you know, tweet, buy ribeyes, buy guns, buy Bitcoin, mm-hmm. you know, in that order, right. Which makes, you know, I was a pescatarian for 10 years. And in the first year, I was benefiting from it. I don't think I was benefiting after that from it. But, you know, and you grow up in a world where the government tells you, or whoever, the FDA is like, bread's the most important part of your diet. You know, mm-hmm. you know, I'd go into a pizza place and there'd be a picture of like a pizza and they're like, you're getting everything here. You're getting the bread, you're getting the tomato, you're getting the meat. And so, yeah. And so you start realizing like, I don't know if they're lying to me, but, or maybe they're just incentivized to sell this stuff. But so you fall into the Bitcoin rabbit hole and then you realize that, you know, you start relearning a lot of things and you learn new things. And I think so as an, you know, as a Bitcoiner, you kind of want to speed that process up and talk to other Bitcoiners who are further along in that path and kind of see where or hear where they think it's going and or their opinions on different things. Because there a lot of times Bitcoiners are coming from, I think, everything now from very first principles. Mm-hmm. So it's just it's a solid framework to come at things.
Yeah, I'm of the opinion that a lot of Bitcoiners approach proselytizing Bitcoin incorrectly, and that's partially why we've tried to craft the website into the meme brand that we have, is because we want to get people asking the question, right? And I think the better question to ask people, you know, that are interested in Bitcoin or even people that are not interested in Bitcoin is, what happens in a world where government no longer controls the money?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like the 3D printing question. What happens in a world where government can no longer control the issue of weapons?
Right.
Right. Because it's happening, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing or not, whether you embrace it or not, it doesn't really matter. Right. Because you could have been an internet denier or a computer denier or an automobile denier. It didn't matter because the world went on without you.
Right.
So a better way to think about this for people who haven't spent the last 4 years dedicating their life to it is to ask the question, what happens in a world where the government can't control the money? Because that is Bitcoin and that is happening.
All right. So I'll ask you, what happens in a world where the government doesn't control the money? And here we are. It happened in a sly way. It's coming. There's nothing government can do other than, you know, like, ban it in their country and push the benefits to another country. So what happens?
I tweeted about this the other day. 50, 60 years of postponing liquidation of malinvestment, with malinvestment brought on by expansion of the monetary base, expansion of credit, manipulation of the interest rates. You know, companies that don't make any money and yet exist for years and years and years. Debt that's monetized and remonetized and held as collateral, toxic assets that nobody wants to hold, but somebody has to hold because our financial system depends on it. Negative yielding sovereign bonds. Doesn't make any sense. None of it makes any sense. It's a world turned upside down. All of it has to liquidate. All of it has to settle to the base layer, right? And you might be one of those people who say, you know, Bitcoin will never be the new base layer. We'll have to settle back on gold. And that's probably a completely different conversation for like another day. But
another show.
You know, when you ask what could happen.
Right.
Well, we're going to have to settle on the base layer. And I believe, and so do most other Bitcoiners, that new base layer is Bitcoin because technology eats the world.
I agree. I kind of suspect they'll go to gold and a mixed bag first. Is my thought, and it seems like they're rolling out this great reset. You see the World Economic Forum talking about it a lot. Mm-hmm. It seems like they're prepping people for that to come, and I think, you know, whatever COVID is, they're using this as a way, you know, no crisis goes to waste, and they're using this as a way to accelerate. You know, I think the move online and a centralization of power. And a way to get through this, to patch the monetary system without having to really talk about some of the real ills of the monetary system. Mm-hmm. And I really think that it's a really, you know, it's been a crazy year. even a lot's happened this week. The debate, you know, Trump testing positive. And I think I don't see a lot of change outside of the Bitcoin community yet. And I don't think Bitcoin is big enough to be a lifeboat yet at 200 billion. I think it needs to be one, two trillion, maybe 10 trillion. And you know, we're in this situation where you hear, you know, it's an amazing article, and I agree, it's gradually then suddenly. So I don't know when suddenly happens. And gradually has been going on for like 50 years. And I see more and more people voluntarily giving up their freedoms and not asserting their rights or you know, critically thinking about things. So I'm not sure. I don't. Maybe this can go on another 50 years. Sure. I don't know. Maybe they can print so much money that they can short Bitcoin and lose money over there to make and gain and keep the money over here. I don't know. And I'm an incredible. I think I'm an internal optimist. So I kind of see the sudden. In my mind's eye, I see suddenly happening. But I don't know. I don't know if it's going to take 10 or 20 years or one or two. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm wondering what you think is going to happen over the next 6-12 months, maybe even 5 or 10 years with Bitcoin. And do you think that, the system's going to break and we're going to settle in Bitcoin and, you know, as countries in 3 to 5 years, or is that still a 20 to 30 year thing? And I'm okay either way. I mean, to me, it's savings technology. So I'm not getting at this to talk about price going up. I'm just trying to learn about what you think might happen. Because I think we really agree on where we are. So I'm just curious. Yeah.
Wait. Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to predict the future.
Right.
You know, like if for some reason or another, if international demand for US dollars as a reserve currency were to dry up, and trillions of US dollars were to come flooding back to the United States, you know, the question you asked me earlier, will hyperinflation happen? In that scenario, it's possible, certainly possible, right? You know, it's crazy to me to look at this, because I look at everything through first principles, like you were talking about, and through this economic lens, this Austrian economic lens. I was looking at the inversion of the yield curve, the 10 and 2-year bond spread, like 18, 24 months ago. And I was saying, oh, here come, you know, the next downturn is coming. We're at the tail end of a 10-year bull market, like get out of equities, get into sound stores of value, maybe buy bonds if you want to do a bond trade. And I was telling people this and they were looking at me like I was nuts. Like, you know, coworkers in the office or whatever, like, hey, look at the bond spread, look at unemployment. You know, typically when these things are this low, bad things are going to come. And nobody could have predicted COVID. Maybe some people could have. I don't know. I certainly couldn't have. And when it happened, everyone was
really
quick. To
be honest, though, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I was listening to your show that you had Ben on, Checkmate. Right. And I really think you guys kind of did lay it out the next year. I think you recorded that in the spring of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do think you guys, it was like, I was watching, when I was listening to that, and I revisited, you know, to kind of get gear up for the show. And I was like, wow, like this show could have been recorded yesterday. Because you guys were kind of like, now it's like they're beating around the bush. Like, we know. Now that we're here, like this catastrophe or this panic happens and this pandemic and the markets have reacted the way they have. And you guys kind of, you know, didn't make predictions, but really laid a lot of that out. As other Bitcoiners did, and macro economists and stuff, and
sure,
you know, I don't. And from that regard, like this year doesn't feel like a surprise. It almost feels to me now. I mean, now that we're 6 months into these kind of semi lockdowns, like now I think this is the new normal. I don't think, not that I like it, but I don't think people are going back.
Sure,
I think this is the level has been set, and. You know, listening back to a show like that, and that's why I listen to Bitcoiners, because a lot of those shows, they're just not dated.
Right, yeah, they're evergreen.
Yeah, they're evergreen. And I was listening to that show, and I'm like, they're laying out what I'm going through, what we're going through. They don't know, you know, exactly what's going to happen or what the trigger is, but it's here. And that was what was interesting about the show is you guys are debating, well, what would these triggers, you know, what are the triggers or and what would happen? And that's the tough part. And right. And now that we're 6 months into it, like things are going now, I think from maybe the Bitcoin perspective, slower than I would have thought in this environment. Sure. And again, I'm not talking about price, but I'm talking about awareness and wake up and sort of like that notion. And I, you know, so now I'm like, okay, well maybe that kind of tempers me and that maybe things will just move very slowly and the frog will boil another 8, 10, 20 years.
And it's certainly possible, but
it's, yeah, I mean, like, I think, you know, when you talk about, you know, Bitcoin, awareness, I don't think. And then you talk about maybe, because on that show, you guys talked a lot about, well, what happens if there's hyperinflation or what happens if there's Bitcoinization? And a lot of it sound painful. There was a lot of, it was amazing because you guys were very tempered then. You know, it wasn't like, fuck yeah, let's see what happens, bro. Like, rock on. Like, let's see the way the cookie crumbles. It was very, and now it's happening and it's still very tempered. It's still, so I'm still in awe that it's playing out so slowly, and maybe that's the gradually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say this. I think Bitcoin is an exponential technology in the ways that the internet was and that the computer was, that the smartphone was, and that, you know, the Apple App Store was. Nobody was using it, and then suddenly everybody's using it.
Right, and this is what Michael Saylor talks about, these huge networks that just, they grow, exactly. And they're unstoppable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the question is, when does everybody start to use it? And my fear, I've talked about this with other people before, is that we don't reach hyper awareness of Bitcoin or hyper Bitcoinization before we reach the point of liquidation. And I'll explain what I mean by that. It's very dangerous.
So we're going to go through, I mean, you're saying like, we're going to go through the pain first. That's what I'm hearing.
Most likely. There has to be pain.
Right.
There has to be pain.
Right. And people aren't going to wake up before the pain.
Right. And that's a concern.
Yeah, that's a tsunami coming at all of us.
Right.
Because your concern came through in that show in particular. And when you talk about that theme,
right.
It was almost like you guys had this major trepidation about being right about Bitcoin. And I don't mean that from a, like, you guys don't want to be right about Bitcoin, but like, it's just not going to be good.
No, absolutely.
And
especially
I
if not everyone else is on board yet, because if
that's the thing, people won't be on board until they get hit over the head is what I'm getting out of this. I'm not right. disagreeing and
but
getting
if and when that happens.
Yeah. If and when it's going to happen. I don't know when, but like, I don't think there's an if, because I think it's going to happen to a lot of people, even if the system doesn't fail, they're going to become debt slaves. They're going to become, you know, UBI people,
sure.
UBI workers.
They'll go back to being serfs.
Right. Just a different form with more recreational options.
Sure. Maybe a little bit more healthcare.
Right. And no, and that's kind of what you were digging out, I felt like, a lot with sort of like life on UBI is maybe like then people don't strive to add value to society. And that's the way an economy works is you know, you get what you put into it. And then if you add a lot of value, you're going to get value out of it. And that's broken.
So it's one thing for governments to have as much wealth as they do, right? Because the unique advantage of a government, particularly a democratic government, is that the bureaucrats can constantly point the finger back at us and say, well, you know, this is a democracy. Like, you put us here, you know, we're representing you. We're all in this together, right? You hear that all the time. This is out, like, we made these decisions. We've created this society. And really, we know that's not true, right? Because government is a small collection of individuals, many of whom, most of whom, act in their own best interest. And this small group of individuals, right, that controls government and the businesses that work with the government, that are in bed with the government, benefit the most, right? But when that small group controls the majority of the world's wealth, nobody really gets up in arms about it. No, you don't hear anybody saying the U.S. government controls way too much wealth. You might hear like some libertarians and Austrians talking about it, but it's not a dominant narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if the liquidation of malinvestment happens before the world changes its mind about Bitcoin and starts buying Bitcoin, even if it, you know, if you go out and buy $10 of Bitcoin, you're going to be better off post-hyper-Bitcoinization than otherwise today, right? So if that doesn't happen, like if a mass awareness of if the several thousand hodlers out there just accumulate all the Bitcoin and then the liquidation of debt happens, well, now you're in a bad spot, because now 1,000, 2,000 individuals own most of the world's wealth. People aren't going to stand for that.
Right.
It's different when it's a government, when it's a nameless, faceless bureaucracy, and where people feel like they have a choice, where they can go and cast their vote and feel like they had a say in the matter. It's another thing entirely when you return to what looks like feudalism.
Mm-hmm.
People won't stand for that, not in the 21st century. At least they're going to certainly try to fight that off.
Right.
And what does that look like, right? I mean, that looks like going and taking the wealth of the individuals who you think have stolen from you.
Yeah, I mean, these revolutionary periods are always violent.
I feel like I might have pushed you too melancholy on that one.
No, I'm just trying to wrap my head around that. And I think it's a lot to digest. What do you think of Stephanie Kelton? I don't know if you saw her tweet today.
No, I don't follow her.
Okay, she wrote, "Your periodic reminder that the Federal Reserve's computer keyboard is standing by, ready to power the next relief package. Newly created digital dollars will spring forth to fund whatever Congress decides to spend in a deeply depressed economy. We can safely do many trillions." And I think the end of her argument is that, you know, there's going to be no inflation no matter how much they print. And I mean, I almost thought it was a parody account. It didn't even seem real to me, but this is, you know, the way our thought leaders, our technocrats kind of see the world, and the ability to just print away all problems or I guess pay for whatever they need, which is amazing, because it was only maybe 2-3 years ago when we couldn't pay for any problems that the country was screaming about, like water and Flint or something like that. But now right. It's, you know, I can't help but think it's kind of planned. But I mean, we're doubling and tripling our monetary supply almost quarterly or annually now.
Well, the one thing that coronavirus did, or at least the response to coronavirus did, was move the Overton window on acceptable monetary policy. We went from people thinking it was insane that the U.S. government was monetizing debt and buying toxic assets to everyone kind of just being like, well, of course they have to print $4 trillion. We don't have a choice. Right. I mean, of course they have to do this.
How much do you think like Andrew Yang's campaign was kind of, I mean, where do you think that campaign came from? To me, that just seems like a rollout for UBI and the pandemic unemployment assistance
Andrew Yang's campaign comes from the same place as Bernie Sanders, comes from the same place as, you know,
Do you think Andrew Yang believes in those ideas? Yeah,
totally. I think it comes from the same place as Fidel Castro and...
But, I mean, you've said it. I mean, if we, you know, we give everybody $1 million and nothing changes.
Oh, yeah. It's populism.
Like, you have to give more money to some particular group or groups to make the money printing work.
It's populism.
I just don't understand how he really believes those ideas.
I thought
when I heard that idea maybe 5-10 years ago, I was kind of like, that sounds awesome. You know, robots are going to take everyone's jobs and people are going to, you know, and then they'll be free to write poetry and, go for their life's desires and get the most out of their life.
And I mean, are we really so naive to think that these same conversations haven't been had before?
Right.
Like, so are we really so naive to think that this is something new under the sun, right? That like humanity's never faced this pressing problem of industrialization and like, oh, you know, my job is being replaced. This is where the term Luddite comes from. People who fear technology. The Luddites were a group of weavers in England who had their jobs replaced by mechanized looms, right? And they rebelled. They'd smashed the looms and said, like, we will not be replaced. Rather than trying to take the time to learn a new skill, they went and smashed the looms with hammers and said, no, like, this is not happening.
Yeah, I would argue, yeah, learn a new skill and you'll be okay. But the fact that these ideas are pushed so hard, and I'm not sure if they really believe them. I'm not, or maybe they're just, they're so incentivized to obtain power through that idea or that kind of campaign notion. But Andrew seems a little different to me. I mean, I don't know anything about him. It seemed like his campaign came on out of nowhere and was highly viral, which I'm starting to think that most things outside of Bitcoin Twitter don't obtain viral velocity naturally or organically, per se. And
facilitated,
yeah. And it's very interesting because, you know, I don't know if his idea really, I mean, I guess it's kind of left-leaning.
It's totally left-leaning.
Sure, but I almost felt like his place in the left party was like a sabotage on the left in terms of their center party. And because it's an extremist position to the right, you know. And yet, you know, now you fast forward, I mean, and we're on the pandemic on unemployment assistance, which is a form of UBI. It's like temporary UBI. And it's, I don't believe in coincidences. It just seems teed up to me.
I don't think it even matters. Like, you know, you asked the question, does Yang believe this himself? I don't think it matters if Yang believes this or if Kelton believes this or if Sanders believes this. Because they're either despots or they're fools, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't really want either
in charge or
monetary
leading out, right?
Or creating legislation,
right? Yeah, I mean, I guess on that front, I think you're a libertarianism.
I mean,
a libertarian, I should say, not.
But I have a hard time classifying myself.
I mean, sure. Same here.
I would say I lean anarcho-capitalist.
Right.
But I'm not so sure that could ever work.
Fair enough. I like to go with the Minicus thing just to be get on the path to the anarcho-capitalist thing as sort of like a more achievable goal, just minimize government as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's interesting with the minimize the government. I don't want to necessarily, I don't know if I'm right or wrong on this, but I don't want to necessarily lose the federal union. I would just like the federal government to really stick to like property rights and national defense.
It's impossible.
Okay.
It's impossible because the U.S. tried it, right? I mean, you have to really go back and look at U.S. history closely because there's so many important lessons. And the majority of them happened because of problems around national defense. And not just national defense, but trade wars, right? U.S. trying to send goods, like U.S. has been at war almost every single year since it was created. And a lot of those early wars that you don't learn about in school, like the Quasi Wars, the War of 1812, the Barbary Coast Wars, they were all trade wars, right? The United States was sending shipments of goods to Europe and their ships were being captured and the crews were being enslaved by Tripoli pirates.
I think you can make the argument the trade wars are currency wars too.
Perhaps.
Or precede currency wars, maybe.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think...
Because
currency
wars are trade wars, is what you mean?
Or I think trade wars are currency wars.
Okay.
You know, I think that it's a form of currency settlement.
Sure. Trade, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's also, I mean, it's also force, obviously. But I think at its root, I think it's... Because if you know, the borders were open and trade was fluid, then... You might not have the actual war, but if the borders are open or semi-open or controlled and the prices are fixed, that I think can lead to imbalances that one side might not appreciate.
Right. And that's the problem with anarcho-capitalism, right? Is that like if the entire world were anarcho-capitalist tomorrow, maybe it would work. But if the US became anarcho-capitalist tomorrow, well, now how do we deal with China? How do we deal with Europe? How do we deal like all of these countries that were a problem 200 years ago are still a problem today, right? And that was really why we ended up with some like John Adams in the Quasi Wars made it illegal to criticize the United States government. And this was like shortly after America was founded.
Right. Well, I mean, that's kind of like the Whiskey Rebellion with Washington. You know, I mean, you know, we have a rebellion against England. And, you know, I think in today's framework or terms, you know, the American revolutionaries would be called terrorists or, you know, insurgents. And then, now that you have this new government, they need to tax to raise money because they're no longer on the, you know, the British money. And so then they got to tax the whiskey farmers and they were like, hell no, and raised arms and Washington had to send the army to squash it.
Well, same thing with the American Civil War. It was all over taxes.
Right, right. Well, okay. Actually, what do you mean it was over taxes?
So there was a tax. Well, there's history. Right, you have to go back and look at the tariffs of abomination, and you have to look at the Nullification Act, and you have to look at the Virginia-Kentucky Resolution. But it culminated under the Morrill Tariff Act. See, the U.S. South prior to the Civil War was an export economy. Right, they produced lots of cotton, lots of raw goods.
Right,
and most of that they sent to Europe, and then they bought finished goods from Europe in exchange.
Directly into the South? The finished goods came into the South?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And as a part of that exchange of raw goods to Europe. The North was a manufacturing economy and wanted the South to buy goods from them. Right. They wanted them to sell their raw goods to Europe but buy finished goods from the North. But the South didn't want to do that because they were more expensive. So the Morrill Tariff Act was an act that placed a tariff on the importation of finished goods from Europe.
The Morrill Tariff Act? Is that
M-O-R-R-I-L.
Okay, got it.
And that was what started the war. That was what led to the secession of South Carolina, was the Morrill Tariff Act.
If we could just jump over to maybe 1933, I've read that there were price controls enacted at that time. And that's something I'm just not, I mean, I know about it, but maybe you could elaborate on what those things were. I don't think most people even have heard of that as a complete blind spot.
There was a ton of things that happened in 1933. I did a whole series on this in our newsletter, like our blog posts for WTF 1971. That was when Social Security was created. That was when Executive Order 6102 was passed. That was when labor unions were sort of like really kicked into high gear. That was when it was some sort of equal opportunity of housing. They started subsidizing crops. The FDR administration did a whole the Agricultural Adjustment Act, where they burned oranges and paid farmers not to grow certain amounts of food and slaughtered pregnant pigs. And it just did all kinds of insane things while half the country was starving in order to try to drive up crop prices to help the farmers, right?
To maintain margins, right? Yeah. That's crazy. This stuff is not taught, you know? No, I mean, maybe you hear about the New Deal and how amazing it was.
Interestingly, though, if you just go spend some time poking around on Wikipedia, it's all there. Even though it's, you know, our history has mostly been whitewashed. Like, if you just do a little digging and like you just have a curious mind, it's all there. Even on like Wikipedia, which is mostly, you know, leftist slant.
What have been some of your favorite sources to glean some of the knowledge that you've gained?
Wikipedia for sure. And then, you know, like Rothbard, like I have this here. The History of Money and Banking in the United States by Murray Rothbard.
Right.
This starts from colonial times all the way up until, I think, I want to say like Bretton Woods time frame. I'm not 100% certain, but that's a phenomenal resource. Like anything on Mises.org, And really, like, you kind of have to, like, dig into these things a little bit for yourself. Like, you hear a topic like, oh, the moral terror effect. I've never heard of that. You've got to be willing to go, like, look it up for yourself and be like, what was this about?
Right.
And then you say, oh, it caused X, Y. And I would honestly, people dog on me for this, but I've learned more on Wikipedia than probably any other resource. Because if you start digging into the stuff that, like, people don't visit often and hasn't gone back and been sort of, like, cleaned up, you'll find there's a lot to be learned if you can connect the dots and, like, really branch out with an unbiased approach as to what really happened in history.
Yeah. Pierre Richard said the same thing on our first show. They learned everything from Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. But you have to be willing to dig into the history yourself and form your own conclusions and gather the data on your own, so to speak.
Right. I want to switch over to custody real quick, because I think you have an interesting take on this. Where do you stand on multi-sig? And I'm talking about multi-sig where you work with a third party, not Bitcoin Core, and you're running your own Electrum, you know.
Right. In terms of a third party,
who maintains, okay. And what?
Why? Like a third party that you don't have a relationship with?
No, well, I mean, you know, you have a relationship, you're paying them.
Like Unchained Capital.
Yeah, or Casa. So, you know, a 3 out of 5 or a 2 out of 3. Well, let's get into that. So, and I think the why is, when you say why, I want to hear, you know, I say, why not? But I go further, I say, well, then what is my alternative that's better?
Put your multi-sig key in an envelope and give it to your lawyer. Or keep it at your grandma's house, or bury it in your backyard. Why would you give it to an audited financial institution?
So let's dig into this a little bit further. Before we get to how to do a multi-sig without a third party, because I'd like to touch on that very briefly from a layman's perspective. But before we get to that, you know, my understanding with Casa or Unchained is that the key that they quote unquote hold is not them holding it, but like a self-recovered key that only you can recover. They can't even recover it. I haven't looked at the source code, so
sure.
I can't.
Neither have I.
You know, I can't verify that. But then go further. It was interesting because you brought up an interesting topic, an offshoot of that, which is, you know, the state is going to go for whatever they can seize. I'm not saying they're going to seize your Bitcoin, but if they could or they wanted to, they're going to start with what the low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're going to go to these third parties and say, give me the one key of 5. So I'm kind of digging into, like, would they have the ability? And I don't know. From my impression, they wouldn't have the ability to give that one key out. But let's say they could, and I understand then, you know, your argument there was, well, now they're going to come to your business or your house and look for the second key in the safe or seize your phone or whatever.
Or your safety deposit box or whatever.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I get that line of thinking. My question there, and I don't know if you have the answer, but is, you know, do they have the ability to give up that key? And maybe that question can't be answered now. But then, and then the second question is like, okay, so are you suggesting something different than multi-sig or maybe a stronger, more secure multi-sig where you do everything yourself? And then my follow-up to that is like, how easy or what would you recommend for someone who's like, okay, I'm ready to do that, but like, tell me what to do.
Yeah, I mean, so multi-sig should be pretty obvious, right? I mean, if you have one key with the traditional setup versus if you have 3 and you need 2 of those 3 in order to transact, which one is more secure? I mean, that's a pretty, that's a no-brainer.
So multi-sig is better.
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, it's always going to be an improvement.
So we've established that.
A single key.
Yeah. So now we're in the framework of like, how do I do multi-sig, but not through a third party? And I know there are ways to do that, but where are you steering me? Are you steering me towards Bitcoin Core? What kind of process is that like? And just briefly, I mean, from a like high level, like, is that a 15-minute thing? Is that a, you know, you got to study this for a few weeks before you get going? And for what kind of user is that for then? And maybe not from a balance standpoint, but from a, you know, long-term security standpoint. Like, so you're going to lock this up for 10, 20 years. This is the way you go, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think Michael Flaxman has a really good approach here. So does J.W. Weatherman. I mean, like, in terms of what kind of user, you know, we're talking about funds that you're not going to touch for 10 years. We're talking about $100,000 plus Bitcoin today, right? Mm-hmm. That could be worth who knows how much in the future. Sure. And you want to spread out your risk, right?
Yeah.
You
even if it's worth $100,000 in the future, it's a lot of money.
Exactly.
Right.
You want to reduce your exposure. I'm not talking about, you know, $1,000 on a Trezor.
Right.
That you need to get set up on a distributed multisig tomorrow. Right. I'm talking about like substantial sums of money, like your net worth types of money. I think I'm always going to advocate Bitcoin Core, just because Bitcoin Core is one of the most heavily reviewed pieces of software in the world.
Right.
By some of the best programmers and security experts in the world.
And what do you think it takes to sidle up to Bitcoin Core if you're coming from scratch? Maybe you just bought a $500 or $1,000 buy on whatever Cash App, and you're like, I want to get to my net worth balance of whatever, so I'm going to set this up now, or I'm going to set this, you know, when I get my next buy, another $1,000, I'm going to set it up and start adding to it.
Right. I mean, right now, like people like J.W. Weatherman are doing things like Yeti Cold, which is really just like a very simple script that runs over the top of Bitcoin Core that makes things like multisig really easy. I think Caravan does something similar where you can run it on your own, but I don't know enough about their product. I don't know if it's Bitcoin Core. I think Glacier Protocol does something similar. So like there's multiple iterations of this kind of popping up, which is just like a package, a wrapper around Bitcoin Core that just makes the UI of setting up multisig a little easier. If you were to just download Bitcoin Core on your computer and think you're going to set up a multisig for yourself, like it's not going to happen.
Right.
It's going to take a lot of time to figure out what's going on there. And really, like if you're doing this process, my thing with hardware wallets is that like they're really only secure as the computer you plug them into. Which for most people is not very secure. So like if you're talking about a lot of money and you need to take security seriously, you need to be considering consulting like a security expert. You need to be looking at, you know, buying new generic hardware specifically for the purpose of generating these keys. And I'm, you know, like I'm following, I don't know that I don't have a perfect answer yet.
Yeah.
I think JW's Yeti Cold thing is pretty close. You know, if you're not willing to pony up for your own proprietary solution. I don't know that it's there yet. You know, like I'm still watching the code review on that and bugs are still being ironed out. But I think, you know, that's really what you want to look at is something like, you know, you buy two old refurbished laptops online and you throw new hard drives in them and you put Bitcoin Core on one of them and the other one you always keep offline. You use that for your key gen and you transfer. I mean, it's a process for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's the cost of losing your $500,000 investment that you just talked about? I mean,
right.
You've got to be willing to take it seriously if you're talking about that type of security.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. I really appreciate that. This has been awesome. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. You know, where can people find you, Heavily Armed Clown? I'll front you. I think that your Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast is awesome. I think people, you know, really should dive into that. I think it's one of the best conversations about Bitcoin going, especially I think when you have Ben on. I think your rapport between you and Ben is awesome, sweet. And I really appreciate your point of view because it's very heavily economics based, Austrian economics for sure. And I think it's clear, concise, and you know. Yeah, I mean, I've been following you for a year and a half now. You know, I remember coming home, you know, in the bear market, and the only person I could really talk to about Bitcoin at that point that would listen for a continuous dialogue would be my wife, and I would be like, "You got to hear what Heavily Armed Clown said today," and you know, I mean, and it's just, you know, it's kind of ridiculous, but at the same time, you're just really coming at it with some of the best stuff in the space. So, and I think this movement with the what the fuck happened in 1971 is really going to open some eyes. So I appreciate all you're doing. I kind of stole a little of your thunder, but if you could tell us where you're at on the web so people can find you.
I really appreciate it, man. You seem like a really smart guy, and I'm honestly humbled. Like, anytime I hear somebody say, like, oh, dude, I love your stuff, I'm just like, me? I'm just like some dude. Like, definitely, I don't know. It blows my mind.
It was really hard. I've done some almost like investigation on myself to kind of not just even learn – to learn where I came into Bitcoin and what were the things that kind of like opened my eyes and really kind of punched through to me. But then even more recently, like what kind of kept me going and what kind of got me through the bear season. Because, you know, for someone like myself, I came in 2017, really at the end. I started looking, I heard about Bitcoin maybe in September and October via Twitter. Maybe earlier, I don't know, but it really started to really punched me in the face, and I couldn't refute anything. And then, I buy some Bitcoin, some sats, and fast forward 3, 4, 5, 6 months, you're in a terrible bear market. And then you go through a year of that, and you're still learning, and you're still hanging out. But you're still, you need those, like, that motivation. It's not motivation, but, like, that continued dialogue.
Clarity.
And you're learning new things. And then, you just dropped in my feed. And it's one of those things where, I'm learning about different things now, like gun rights. And the movie The Joker comes out. And you come in my feed. And I can't help but link the two. And I can't get over the fact I'm taking advice from this picture. I just couldn't get over that. But what you had to say, just like I said before, just really cut through the noise.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then you start thinking about that kind of a non-personality, and it was also interesting too because I would come across you on podcasts, and it was really hard to link you with your website and your your own podcast because you got this a non-persona going on, and then I'd be listening to like maybe like you and Ben and Guy on Peter McCormick or even before that when it was just two of you, and I'd be like, well, what the fuck? This is that guy I follow. And then you link them, and then you start. I almost go back to your timeline at that point and rereading everything, trying to understand how I didn't connect the dots and why you kind of broke through the noise. So it's really been a pleasure. So I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, man. And you had asked me where your listeners can find me. That's probably just at HeavilyRMC on Twitter, or check out the newsletter at WTF1971.com.
Yeah, I really recommend everyone check it out. It's great. It's good stuff. And go back, dig into the catalog of Bitcoin Echo Chamber. You've got great guests, and like we were saying before, it's evergreen, and I enjoy the vibe between you and Ben when you have them on. So thanks so much, bro. Peace.
Thanks a lot, man.
I want to thank Heavily Armed Clown for dropping a ridiculous amount of knowledge and insight into 20th century economics and what the fuck happened in 1971 right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the show, please vote with your thumbs and press those 5 stars. That's the best way to spread the word. This is Cedric. Peace.